Dr. Hyquin talked about development, and the Tuesday Times, as always, is on the case. And in today's Science Times, there is a long, interesting article on development, which, of course, you can get on the web. Now, she talked about the way a cell becomes specialized to make a specialized set of proteins. And what I want to do today is continue talking about a couple of those kinds of cells, those very specialized cells, how once they start making those special proteins, they do their special function. And we'll talk a little bit about a coordination today, and then next week, there's no class on Thursday, on Tuesday next week, we will talk about homeostasis, which is how you actually coordinate all the activities of the organism. So I want to come back and talk some more about muscle. Last time I lectured, we talked about the three major kinds of muscle. We said, and actually they're listed up here, there's smooth muscle, skeletal muscle, and cardiac muscle. Now, they all have certain similarities, and I'll talk about that first, and then we're going to talk about the special properties that each of them has. And what we're going to do today, basically, is go over the handouts that you have. There are four pages. We'll definitely get through three. We may or may not get through the fourth one. Now, we said this last time, but it was a while ago. What properties do all of these kinds of muscles have in common? Now, of course, they all contract. But they all do that in the same basic fashion, in that they have two major proteins that carry out the contraction, actin and myosin. And we already know that myosin is the so-called motor molecule for actin. It allows movement. And both of them are found in all three types of muscle. And they make up what are called the thin filaments. And the thick filaments. That's because, literally, myosin is bigger than actin. And in all these muscle types, the way the contraction of the muscle works is not by contraction of these proteins. These proteins stay the same length, but they slide relative to each other. And this is common in all three cases. And the contraction in all three cases is triggered by a rise in cytoplasmic calcium. And by cytoplasmic, we mean in the soluble cytoplasm, not in the organelles, but in the rest of the cytoplasm. So the calcium triggers the contraction, which is due to sliding. And in all these cases, the actual sliding, the movement of actin relative to myosin, requires the splitting of ATP. So that provides the energy. And in all of these cases, the actual enzymatic activity for splitting the ATP resides in the myosin part. So myosin is said to be an ATPase. So to give you some idea of what I mean, I have here a model. And this is more like what skeletal and cardiac look like. But in all cases, there's a similarity. So in this model, the red is actin. And it is attached to something. In skeletal muscle, it is attached to a structure like this. So in skeletal muscle, or in cardiac, in all striated muscle, you have structures made of protein, and the actin is connected to them. And then the myosin is in the middle. So this is myosin and actin. Now, in smooth muscle, it's a little different in that the actin is not connected to a protein, a bunch of proteins arranged in a line, but in something else. So the equivalent structures, this is called the Z line. It consists of more than one protein. And it's found in all striated muscle. And this is called a dense body. And these structures are all shown on handout 19A. Now, where is the myosin? It's in the same equivalent spot. So the myosin is in here. So again, you have actin and myosin arranged with the actin sort of tied down at the ends relative to the myosin. So if we go back to our little structure here, this is one so-called unit. And here is the actin, the red stuff. And the green stuff is the myosin. Now, myosin actually has little heads that stick up and connect to the actin. So these would be the blue things here would be the heads. I can't help it that this is blue too. There are only so many pieces in this kit. So the green here is the myosin, and these are the heads, and they're attached to the actin. And the actin is anchored. And the myosin is anchored by other proteins, which we will leave out. So if you have a relaxed muscle, it looks sort of like this. And if you have a contracted muscle, this one doesn't want to slide. If you have a contracted muscle, it's like this. Now, what's the difference? We slid the actin out relative to the myosin. So in all of these cases, we notice that the myosin is the same length, the actin is the same length. What's different is the space in here. There's less space in here when it's contracted. And there's less space in the middle. So the spaces in the middle, notice what's special about this space? You've got myosin but no actin. And what's special about this space is you've got actin but no myosin. And those spaces where there's no overlap decrease when you contract and expand when you relax. So the distance between the two attachment points changes. But the length of the actin and the myosin stays the same. They just slide. And that's true whether you have a so-called bundle. Of the thick and the thin pyres, or whether you have them arranged in this standard way, which is called a sarcomere. In either case, when you have contraction, the actin moves in relative to the myosin. And the myosin ends get closer to the attachment points. So that's the same in all of these. So I want to look now at some of the details, first in smooth muscle, because it's simpler, and then in skeletal muscle. Now, we explained last time that smooth muscle is actually enormously important in your body. It surrounds most of the tubes in your body, not your capillaries, but anything much bigger than that. Your small blood vessels, your bronchioles and your lungs, your gut, all of that is surrounded by smooth muscle. And smooth muscle is able to maintain an intermediate level of contraction with relatively little ATP input. This is explained in your previous notes. So it has what is called tone. We're talking about smooth. It's able to maintain tone or hold those tubes to the right diameter with relatively little ATP input, relative, that is, to the other kinds of muscle. Now, how is it set up? If you look now at your handout at 19A sideways, we have drawn there a smooth muscle cell on the bottom. We have a relaxed one and a contracted one. And this has been compared to a worm in a mesh bag for reasons that I think are obvious when you look at the picture. That the actin and myosin bundles are arranged along here. Of course, they're inside the cell under the membrane. And you have these dense bodies. And then you have bundles of actin and myosin. And you also have intermediate filaments connecting, in addition to thin and thick filaments, you have intermediate filaments connecting the dense body. And that's why on this handout it says intermediate filament bundles. And you may notice on your previous handout, which had the same picture, I had crossed out intermediate and written actin-myosin bundle. So this little structure here in between two dense bodies actually contains the actin-myosin for contraction, but also intermediate filaments for holding everything together. And what happens now is if the bundles contract, if the actin and the myosin slide, then the mesh gets smaller and the cell, so to speak, crumples, which is why it's like a worm in a mesh bag. Now, the other picture on the top of this handout, there are three little pictures under smooth muscle. The one at the top makes a little clear about how the nerves are connected to smooth muscle. Now, we remember we said last time there are actually two kinds of smooth muscle. There's smooth muscle, which is sort of each cell for itself, like this, where each cell gets a signal and contracts separately. And there are, in the picture shown here, there are smooth muscles where the cells are connected to each other electrically, so that there are gap junctions between the cells. And each of these is an individual smooth muscle cell, but they have gap junctions between them. So if one of them contracts because of a change in its electrical state, all of the others will contract too. So it contracts as a unit. So this is called single unit. This terminology is perhaps backwards, because here you have single cells acting. Here you have a single unit of many cells contracting at a time. So this is called single unit muscle. And when you have individual cells, each doing its own thing separately, that's called multi-unit. Now, in the picture here on the top, it shows the nerves coming in. Now, in a previous handout, I think it was 14, we had a picture of a somatic nerve connecting to a skeletal muscle. And there's an elaborate structure on each side of the synapse. That on the presynaptic side, you have the bouton. You have a very elaborate, and here's the presynaptic side, and here's the post. And you have, from a single nerve, you have an elaborate structure on the end of the nerve, and an elaborate structure over here on the muscle on the postsynaptic side. That's skeletal muscle, and also cardiac. But in smooth muscle, it looks a little different, that the nerve has just little, multiple little swellings in a row, not one on the end, but multiple little swellings in a row, which contain vesicles of neurotransmitter. And they can be released and bind to receptors on the surface of the underlying smooth muscle cell. So the presynaptic structure has these, which are called, as labeled on your hand, varicosities. In the axon feeding in, and then underneath, you don't have an elaborate postsynaptic structure. Instead, all you have are receptors on the surface of the cell. Now, you have to have a receptor to bind neurotransmitter to do anything. And that receptor will eventually, when it's triggered, will open or close channels and change the ion flow and change the electrical state of this smooth muscle. Now, another reason for bringing this picture is that you notice there are two nerves ending on this single unit muscle. And one of them is from the sympathetic, and one is from the parasympathetic. If you have a skeletal muscle, what kind of input does it get? If this were a skeletal muscle, what would this be? Parasympathetic, sympathetic? None of the above. This would be from the somatic nervous system. This would be a motor neuron. So this motor neuron would come in, and that would be it. That would be the only input for contraction, would be a motor neuron. Now, what can a motor neuron tell the skeletal muscle to do? Contract, and that's it. It either gives an excitatory signal and the muscle contracts, or it gives no signal and the muscle relaxes. You either turn it on or you don't do anything. So the only possible signal is excitatory. Now, what's with the smooth muscle? With smooth muscle, you can get two different kinds of signals. You can get an inhibitory signal and you can get an excitatory signal. Usually, sympathetic does one and the parasympathetic does the other. And they do that because they release different neurotransmitters. So one of them may lead to an increase in calcium inside the cell, and one may lead to a decrease. Or they may affect the response to calcium. So either by affecting the calcium level in the cytoplasm or the response to calcium, they can either excite or inhibit smooth muscle, make it contract more or less. Now, there's another big difference here in the signal department. We know that hormones affect muscle. We talked about epinephrine changing glycogen metabolism. But that's not contraction. Hormones don't affect the contraction of skeletal muscle. They affect other aspects of metabolism. But hormones can affect the contraction of smooth muscle. In fact, we met an example of that. We said that epinephrine causes some smooth muscle to contract and some smooth muscle to relax. Remember that epinephrine is the hormone that signals stress or a need to react quickly, and it causes contraction of the smooth muscle around your peripheral arterioles, and it causes relaxation of the smooth muscle around your bronchioles. Now, this is a case where it's the same trigger. It's the same neurotransmitter, but different effects, as opposed to two different neurotransmitters with different effects. And we'll come back to that and see, at the level we're talking about, how does that epinephrine cause contraction versus relaxation? It turns out to have to do with calcium. So smooth muscle gets a lot of different inputs. It gets inputs from the parasympathetic, the sympathetic, and from hormones telling it what to do. And what it does depends on the sub. While skeletal muscle just gets input from motor neurons. Now that's enough about structure. And now we want to consider the question of, once you get high calcium in this cytoplasm, how does that trigger contraction? And that's what the middle picture on your handout is. In all cases, calcium binds to some protein, and that triggers some action. But there's a lot of, maybe we'll start it over here. The protein that calcium binds to is different in smooth and skeletal muscle. In smooth muscle, it's calmodule. I'm going to fill this in as we go. So you might want to leave some room in your notes if you're taking them, for where this table goes. So calcium, calmodulin is going to be the calcium binding protein. It's different than skeletal. Now, in order to get a bridge cycle, we said that actin and myosin slide relative to each other. The way they slide is the head of the myosin sticks to the actin. Then you break that and they move and you form another bridge. You break that, you make another bridge. In the relaxation cycle, you break it and just let it slide. So every time you do this, in order to get any action, you have to let the actin stick to the myosin. Now, in order to do that, something has to change. Because in your relaxed muscle, actin doesn't stick to myosin, or your muscle would contract. So there's something preventing that interaction. either the actin or the myosin isn't ready to go. So which one has to be modified to get some action? In smooth muscle, you have to modify the myosin. Now, as you might suspect, in skeletal muscle, it's the actin. Now, what kind of modification? We know that you can change the properties of a protein by having something bind to it, have an allosteric effect, and shift its shape a little. But we also know that you can chemically covalently modify a protein, like by adding a phosphate or a methyl, and that also could change its properties. So those two are different also. That in smooth muscle, you actually covalently modify the myosin. You add a phosphate to it. So now we want to look at our little picture and see how that goes. So it says figure 830. I think I took this out of Becker. And the idea here is, calmodulin, which, as we mentioned earlier, is a major calcium binding protein. It changes shape on binding calcium. And it does many different things in different types of cells. But in smooth muscle, it's the trigger for contraction. So calmodulin binds calcium. We haven't said where the calcium comes from. And you get a complex. Now, that complex usually binds to some protein, changes the conformation of the protein, and changes the activity. And the protein that it binds to here is a kinase. So it's called MLCK. And it is inactive by itself. But when it binds calmodulin, the combination is active. So I've just written active MLCK. Now, you realize that this is really a complex of the basic enzyme plus the calmodulin calcium. But the thing is, this now has enzymatic activity. Now, it's a kinase. So what does a kinase do? It phosphorylates at the expense of ATP. Who gets phosphorylated? Myosin. So this protein, in turn, now finally does something. And myosin by itself is inactive. In smooth muscle, the myosin is folded in a way so that it can't bind to actin. But when it's phosphorylated with the kinase, it's active. And now it can bind to actin, make a bridge, and start the contraction cycle. And of course, we needed ATP to do this. Okay, so this is several steps, but the calcium has to bind to calmodulin, the calmodulin has to bind to a kinase, and then the kinase has to phosphorylate myosin. And once the myosin is phosphorylated, it's ready to go, it's ready to bind to actin and start what's called a bridge cycle. We don't actually know the details of the bridge cycle very well in smooth muscle. It's thought to be similar, but not the same as in skeletal, and we'll do the skeletal one pretty closely in a minute. Now, we've already said that epinephrine causes some smooth muscle to contract and some smooth muscle to relax. How does that fit into this picture? We know that when epinephrine causes contraction, it does it through the IP3 pathway. And when it does it through relaxation, it does it through the cyclic AMP pathway. So why would that work? What does IP3 usually do? It goes to the ER, binds to receptors, opens channels, and causes release of calcium. So IP3 causes the calcium inside the cell in the cytoplasm to rise. Now, why will that trigger contraction? More calcium, more activated calmodulin, more active kinase, more active myosin, contraction. Now, how could cyclic AMP cause relaxation? It turns out, remember, cyclic AMP activates protein kinase A. So that kinase phosphorylates the first kinase. Protein kinase A works on the myosin kinase, adds a phosphate to it, and makes it inactive. It keeps it stuck. Phosphorylation of the kinase keeps it stuck, the kinase stuck, in the inactive form. So we have a kinase phosphorylating a kinase, which turns out not to be all that uncommon. And this is now inactive. Now, what does inactive mean? What does the active one do? It binds to calmodulin. So this one can't bind calmodulin. So if you generate cyclic AMP in the cell, you activate protein kinase A, which inactivates myosin kinase and keeps it out of commission. So even though there's calcium in the cell, it doesn't trigger anything. Because the calcium calmodulin cannot bind and activate kinase, and you can't activate myosin. Now I have a question for you. You have smooth muscle. You add epinephrine. What determines whether it will relax or contract? What is it about that smooth muscle that determines what it will do? So I want you to discuss that for a minute with your neighbor and come to a conclusion. What is the critical factor? Now I'm going to call on somebody. You can always blame it on your partner, but I'm going to call on somebody. What do you think? Different G proteins. First she said different receptors, then she said different G proteins. Does it have, how many people think it has a different receptor? Get different response. Different receptor? Different G protein? Both? Aha. It's going to be both. Because if you have, you have to, what do you have to do here? To get IP3, you have to turn on one enzyme. To get cyclic AMP, you have to turn on a different enzyme. One of them, you need to turn on phospholipase C. One, you need to turn on adenyl cyclase. So what determines that? Different G proteins turn on the different enzymes. But who turns on the G proteins? And that's different receptors. So you're going to have, you might have, you probably have adenyl cyclase and phospholipase C in the same cell. But a particular receptor turns on a particular G protein, which activates one or the other, thereby triggering that pathway. Now, with two things we left out here. First of all, where does the calcium come from to run this? In smooth muscle cells, the calcium can come from the ER, or the calcium can come from the outside. But in most cases, most of it comes from the outside. That is, in order to get a cell to contract, usually you open channels in the plasma membrane, which allows calcium in. Sometimes you open channels in the ER. These cells are relatively small, so if you open channels to the outside, you can get enough calcium into the cell, all over the cell, to trigger contraction. Skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle are too big for that. The cells are so big that if you open a few holes or channels in the membrane, you can't get enough calcium deep into the cell to trigger contraction. So in those cases, you have to release calcium from the ER. So if we say the source of the calcium, it can be both, but it's usually outside, and here it's usually the ER. But there can be some ER. Now, we said the bridge cycle is not understood very well in smooth muscle, but the one thing we do know is that, remember, to run a bridge cycle, you always need to split ATP. You need to blow a little ATP to get the myosin in shape. But once that molecule of myosin is ready to go, it can bind actin, split, bind actin, split, bind actin, split. And each time you do that, you have to blow an ATP. And we think that in smooth muscle, you can hold it longer than in skeletal muscle. So the number of ATPs you have to split to hold a contraction is smaller. So it's more economical. The bridge cycle is more economical in smooth muscle. Now, if you want real oomph and force, you need skeletal muscle. But just to hold your guts in every day, that's smooth muscle. It has some skeletal too, but... Okay. Now, I think that's what I wanted to say about smooth muscle, and now I want to look at skeletal muscle in contrast. But before I do that, let me ask if there are questions. Yes? In skeletal muscle, almost all the calcium comes from the ER, and we'll explain how that works in a few minutes. Yeah.
I'm a little unclear still how each muscle can have different, or each muscle cell can have different receptors for the same hormone and still be specific.
Okay, her question is about the two different hormones. If we have two different kinds of receptors here, I see what your question is. Any particular smooth muscle is going to have one of these two receptors on it. So this kind of smooth muscle that contracts has one kind of receptor, which triggers one kind of G protein, which triggers phospholipase C. But this kind of smooth muscle has the other kind of receptor, which binds epinephrine, triggers a different G protein, activates adenyl cyclase, and generates cyclic AMP. Now, some smooth muscles, I think, have a combination, but generally you have one or the other. Yes? Is where is all this stuff? As far as I know, the calmodulin is in the cytoplasm where the calcium is generated, and that it then goes to the kinase, which I don't know where the kinase is. I assume it's also cytoplasmic, and the fibers are in the cytoplasm, but they're tied down.
And where is the nucleus in the smooth muscle?
It would be like in a regular cell somewhere. Where's the nucleus, she wants to know. It's no special place as far as I know. But let me just say that there are many different kinds of smooth muscle with many different fine adjustments. And you have to look into more advanced work if you want to know the details of that. Yeah?
Does the myosin polymerize to itself to make a filament?
Does the myosin polymerize to itself to form a filament? Both myosin and actin polymerize. The monomer forms polymers. And as far as I know, that's spontaneous. But there are other proteins in the cell which influence the speed of polymerization versus depolymerization and attach those proteins to other proteins, all of which we are ignoring. I believe that, again, more advanced texts go into the details. Okay, so let's go on and talk about skeletal, and perhaps in contrast, some of these other things will also become clearer. Now, for skeletal muscle, we want to look first at its structure, and then we'll see about how it contracts. So its structure is on that same handout, 19A. Now, a single muscle fiber is a single cell. And this is a single large multinucleate cell. It's formed during development by the fusion of many, many small cells. So all these cells fuse together to form this giant cell. And in the picture you had last time, it showed a little clearer that the nuclei are out here. They're on the surface. And the middle is packed with actin and myosin and some other proteins in a regular array. And that's what gives it its striped structure. Now, you notice here that they have a little thing sticking out. That this cell is packed with what are called myofibrils. Each of them has the myosin and actin aligned, and then the myofibrils are aligned. And this is the breadsticks that I brought last time. I brought them one more time. A few people ate a few breadsticks last week, so there are a few less, but the principle is the same. That if this is a single muscle cell or muscle fiber, it would be packed with myofibrils, solid. And then the membranes around here, and the nuclei are largely on the edge. And so this would be one myofibril. Now, the actin and the myosin are lined up in here in a regular way in these sarcomeres that I drew. And then these are aligned relative to each other carefully. And that's why the whole muscle has this regular striped appearance. So we want to look at a single myofibril at how the actin and the myosin are lined up. Now, there are other proteins there, and we'll talk about some of them. But for now, we're going to stick to actin and myosin. So if you actually look at the muscle, you see that if you look at a single fibril, you see that it has this repeating pattern of a dark band, two dark bands with a light, and then there's a larger light like this. And then there's a line here. So this is one sarcomere. In muscle, everything is sarco. So the plasma, the cytoplasm is called the sarcoplasm, the ER is called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, etc. It just means muscle. But a sarcomere is a unit of muscle function. Now remember, this is a two-dimensional slice. The thing is really three-dimensional. And if I draw little things sticking up, they're sticking out this way too. And your books have very nice pictures of slices the other way, so you get a better sense of what it's like in three dimensions. Now, how are things arranged here? This is what we've called the Z line. And what now if we blow this up and try and relate it to our picture over there? So here, instead of drawing a straight line for the Z line, they've drawn this, because the protein probably isn't straight. And then you have, of course, actin attached to it. So this is very much like our previous picture. And then you have the myosin in the middle. Now, as we'll see when we look a little more carefully, the myosin heads are in the part that overlaps the actin, not the entire thing. So that's why it's drawn this way, myosin, actin. Now, you can see here those areas we talked about before, that this area here has actin, it has the Z-line proteins, but it has actin, but it doesn't have any myosin. And what does that correspond to on the top? That would be, if I look at this section here, I should draw the line just right. Here's the myosin from one sarcomere. Here's the myosin from the other sarcomere. Here's where the myosin is sticking in. But here there's only actin. And so thin, you can't see it in this stripe, in the stained pictures. So this is the Z line with actin. And this is the part that has no myosin, only actin. And this is the part that has myosin, but no actin. Now, what those are called is, this is called, this section here that has no myosin is called the I band. It's labeled on your handout. This is the I band. And then this part in the middle right here. That corresponds to this. That has no actin, just myosin. And that's called the H zone. I don't think that one's labeled on your handout. So those are the parts that get smaller when the sarcomere slides. So if we look at our little model again, here is our relaxed version. Gotten a little bit squished by dropping it, but it's basically the same. Here is our relaxed cell. So here would be part of the I-band. This is half an I-band because the other half is over here. And here is half an I-band. Other half is over there. And this is the part that has actin and no myosin. And this is the H-zone in the middle that has myosin and no actin. And you see that when you contract it, the H and the I get smaller, the two Zs get close to each other, but the actin and the myosin stay the same. Okay. All right, so that's all I want to say about the structure at that level, unless there are questions. Yes?
Does the H zone disappear entirely?
Does the H zone disappear entirely? I don't know. I think it gets very small, but I don't know if it disappears. If you get the muscle too contracted, it can't pull anymore because there's no more room for the actin and the myosin to overlap. Yeah?
Is the Z line visible in the staining, or is it just drawn?
Is the Z line visible in the staining? Yes, it is. So this picture here represents what you would see in a standard staining picture. Yeah?
Could you please clarify that it's between the I band and the Z line?
The Z line is this thing right here, represented. The question is, what's the difference between the Z line and the I band? The I band is this space, actually the entire space here. This entire area here is called the I band. And this attachment point is called the Z line. And in this kind of magnification, it appears straight. Now, how does this lead to contraction, etc.? How does the sliding work? This is what people call the bridge cycle, and that's drawn on B. But before we look at the details of the bridge cycle, we want to look a little more closely at the thick and thin filaments, the myosin and the actin. And that's shown in the upper half, upper left of your handout. There's a little blow-up of what myosin looks like and a little blow-up of actin. And you can see that what's on the top, which is myosin, is the thick filament, is literally thicker. It has a bigger diameter. And you see all those little heads on the two ends. And that's what's going to connect to the actin. Now, a single thick filament has many individual molecules of myosin in it and many, many heads. We're going to look in a minute at how one head contacts actin at a time, but they're really very many. Now, what's drawn underneath is the thin filament, which is the actin. Now, you may remember that we said that there is so-called globular actin. And then the globular actins assemble to make chains, and then you get two chains around each other, and that's fibrous actin or F-actin. So a thin filament is basically made of F-actin, but it has other proteins on it which are critical to contraction. This by itself would be F-actin. But now if you look at that picture, you see that there's another thing on top. There is tropomyosin. Subunits are arranged in a filament, and they go along each chain of actin. So you have two of these wound around each other, and then you have the tropomyosin is on top. Now remember we said that any time that you're going to make a bridge and you're going to contract, you have to get the myosin to stick to the actin. Now in smooth muscle, you have to phosphorylate the myosin, but you have to change the myosin. But in skeletal muscle, it's the actin that you have to change. So if we look back here at our table, it's the actin we have to modify. And we're not going to covalently change it. We're just going to actually, it's actually not the actin, but sort of the actin, the thin filament fiber. We're going just to change its conformation. And we're going to do that by the calcium, effects of calcium. Now, what I've got here is tropomyosin. And tropomyosin covers up the parts of the actin that stick to the myosin. So myosin can't stick to actin because the binding site is underneath the tropomyosin. So we have to push the tropomyosin out of the way, and that will allow the actin, myosin, to get it together. To push the tropomyosin out of the way, you need one more protein here, and that's shown on your handout. It's actually a complex of several proteins called troponin. And the troponin is drawn down here. And this is the actual calcium binding protein, is the troponin. So in smooth muscle, calcium binds to calmodulin. That leads to the phosphorylation of myosin, and now you can start the Briggs cycle. In skeletal muscle, calcium binds to troponin. That pushes the tropomyosin out of the way, exposing the actin. And now the actin and the myosin can get it together in order to do a bridge cycle. Now, you could say it's really the tropomyosin and the troponin that change conformation, but the net effect is to expose a piece of actin that was covered up. So this structure changes conformation. Nothing is covalently modified. But it changes conformation, and now you can start a bridge cycle. So the rest of, let's look now at that little picture on the right, which is the setup for the bridge cycle. Let me find my eraser. Good eraser. Where did I put it? I'm just going to draw it down here. So we have a sort of diagrammatic version of a little piece of a sarcomere up here in the corner on the handout. This would be the Z line, and here would be one pair of actin thin filaments. And then in the middle, we would have one myosin thick filament. And we've just drawn one to make life easy. And to keep it very simple, I've just got one pair of heads on the myosin, although of course there are many. Now on the actin, there are multiple binding sites for myosin. And what's going to happen as the muscle contracts is that the actin's going to, right here, the myosin is attached to, is opposite the ones. If I slide the actin in, the myosin will be under the twos. And if I slide even further, the myosin will be under the threes. And what we want to look at is how the myosin-actin combination goes from this state to one more contracted, which is drawn underneath. And the basic idea now is that the myosin, although the same length, has its heads under the twos instead of under the ones. How do we get from one state to the next? Now, to keep it simple, we're just going to look at this part. We're going to look at half of it. Actually, we're looking at even less, but we're only going to look at half. We're going to see how this myosin head moves from actually being under the two to being under the three. And that's what that whole diagram is underneath. That's the bridge cycle, and we're going to go through it. Now, this cycle is drawn in both textbooks and many, many figures, usually in a more realistic fashion. This is diagrammatic to try and make the major points. So here we have the blow-up of the actin with the three binding sites on it. Now, this actin actually would be longer. We've left it off, and it would be connected to the Z line. But we haven't drawn that in the picture. We have a little box, but we haven't connected the end of the actin to the Z line. And then we have underneath the myosin. Now, this is a cycle, and we could start anywhere we wanted. But I want to start, this is A. I don't want to start with step 4, I'm going to start with step 1. So this means we want to look at state B, where again you have your actin with the 3 sites. But the myosin now is cocked or bent. Now, why did I pick this? Why did I pick 1 if I have to start somewhere? In a resting muscle, thrusting skeletal muscle, this is the way the actin-myosin combination looks. And I should have drawn that's longer. That the myosin is sort of cocked and ready to go, but it's not connected to the actin. Why not?
Because you're not contracting.
What's blocking this? Remember the tropomyosin, troponin business? So that's blocking here. And it is calcium that allows us to move that out of the way. So when calcium comes along, that's going to signal the uncovering of the actin and allow the cycle to start. So this is the place it waits for calcium, which is the normal resting state, no calcium. Calcium comes, we start a contraction. So we'll go from state 1 then, and we'll continue this cycle. Now we're going to do it first without the ATP, and then we'll come back and put the ATP in. So in step 1, what you do is you actually connect. Now that the tropomyosin has been pushed out of the way by the troponin, now what can happen is that the myosin head can actually connect to the actin. And that's step 1. Then in step 2, now what can happen is we have what people usually call the energy stroke, the real push. The myosin is going to straighten up. If you think of it as being sort of like a coil that you've pulled, like a spring, you've pulled the spring back, you've attached it to its target, and now you let the spring go. So what it's going to do is it's going to straighten up, and it's going to push the actin over. And so that's why at the end of 2, you have D, which looks like So now we have pushed the actin over. Now, if I had drawn in the Z line, it would pull the Z line with it. And the space here between the end of the myosin and the Z line would get smaller. That's your I zone in that picture. So this part would get smaller. And the space in the middle would get a little bit smaller. Now, we need to do one more thing. The actin and the myosin are still connected. It turns out this is the part where you need to bind ATP. If you run out of ATP, you can't continue. You need ATP to split these two apart and to give you the final state, which I've written here as E. Now you notice I've written on the bottom E equals A. What's the difference between E and A? You notice there isn't any, except that we've moved one over. That in E and A both, you have the myosin upright, not cocked, under the actin, not connected. And so we're really going to start it again. After all, it's a cycle. And so this really goes back up to the beginning. So this is step 3. And so this is the same as the very top, and now we have step 4. In the absence of calcium, we'll continue one more step, but we won't go any further. Now, to understand how you get from A or E to B, how you carry out step four, we have to put in the ATP. So where should we do that? Remember, it's a cycle. We can start anywhere we want. But we said you need ATP to break the connection between actin and myosin. So in a way, this is the best place to put in the ATP. At this stage, there is no ATP. And step three involves the binding, but not the splitting, of ATP. So we have to bind ATP. So there's ATP here. So we could write it, if we want to write it on the side. There's no ATP there, but there's ATP here. But notice it's not split. Now, in order to cock the myosin, to bring the spring back and get it ready to go, you actually have to split the ATP. So at this stage, you still have ADP and you still have PI stuck to the actin myosin. It hasn't left, but it's been separated into two halves. And now in the next two steps, first you lose the phosphate and then you lose the ADP. So in step two, let me just see if I got this right. Yeah. So now you would stop here if there was no calcium and wait. When the calcium comes along, notice that the myosin is ready to go. The myosin is cocked. You've split the ATP. And now all you have to do is let the spring go. So what happens in step two, the so-called power stroke, is you probably lose the phosphate, and it's not quite clear what triggers what, but you lose the phosphate and you straighten up the myosin, pushing the actin over. And then at the end, you lose the ADP. Now, the books disagree on when you lose the phosphate part. You lose the ADP here, but you lose the phosphate either here or at 2. Okay, so the simplest way to think about it is that you lose the phosphate at 1 and the ADP is 2. But it may be that it isn't quite so straightforward. But somewhere in here between 1 and 2, you lose the phosphate and you lose the ADP. So when you get down to here, there's no ATP left, no piece of it. We've lost both parts. So another way of looking at it is this one has the ADP. It's not clear about the PI. This one has ADP. This one has no ATP at all. This state B has both ADP and PI, and A has ATP. So, yeah? Well, her question is, how does the myosin get lined up with the 2 versus the 3? The point really is here. At this point, remember this is before when we started, the myosin was under the 2. Then when we did the cocking, so to speak, we pulled it back so it was under the 3. Now it attaches to the 3 and straightens up, pushing the actin. Oh, so if we did it again, we'd really have to start with it under the 3. Absolutely right. So her question is, if when you turn E back into A, it doesn't really look like that. After we've done one cycle, our myosin is here. So in the next cycle, we cock the myosin and stick it under 4. And the next one, we cock it and stick it under 5, etc. So we move over 1 each time. Now remember that myosin really has many, many heads. So you're not breaking them all at once, reforming them all at once. When you relax the muscle, you break them all. But when you keep the muscle contracted, you're breaking and making bonds, head connections, but you don't break them all at the same time, so the muscle remains contracted. So we've only followed one bridge, but many of them are going at the same time. Now, to come back to this regulation business, in a normal cell, you don't run out of ATP, but you do run out of calcium. Calcium is released in a pulse to trigger contraction. When the contraction is supposed to be finished, the calcium is pumped back where it came from, usually into the ER in a case like this. So this is what changes, whether you do or you don't have calcium. There's always enough ATP around, so if there's calcium, you get down to here, you pick up ATP, and you go around again. But when you die, it's a different business. When you die, you run out of ATP. Calcium can no longer be pumped back into where it belongs, so the cell has high calcium and low ATP, which is a state you don't normally have. So if the cytoplasm has low ATP and high calcium, where are you going to get stuck? You're going to get stuck here. This step can't happen. And you're going to get stuck in state D. And this is how you get rigor mortis. And the reason it wears off is that the muscle tissue degenerates and falls apart. But temporarily, you're stuck in this state for 24 to 48 hours, I think. Okay, so I want to leave this and talk about where the calcium comes from, but first let me ask what questions there are about this. Yeah? How does it know which way to move? On the other side, remember everything here is asymmetric. So if you think about springs and stuff, it's fastened the other way on the other side. Yeah?
Where exactly does the ATP bind?
Well, I've deliberately not told you where the ATP binds, because I'm not exactly sure exactly which part of it. Yeah?
How does it get back in the same relative location with the active in the myosin? Does it move from 2 to 3 to 4?
Does it move from 2 to 3 to 4? Yes, it would move actually from 1 to 2 and from 2 to 3 and from 3 to 4.
Just keep going. I mean, how do you get back to the same relative location?
Well, how do you get back to the same relative location? When you run out of calcium, all of the bridges will break. And the muscle will relax to what is essentially all the way with allowing the actin to slide all the way back. Yeah.
Is there no tropomyosin in smooth muscle, and do you need to phosphorylate myosin in skeletal muscle?
Do you need to phosphorylate myosin in skeletal muscle? No. Now, in both cases, you need to split ATP to run the bridge cycle. But to get ready to run the bridge cycle, you don't need to phosphorylate myosin. Now, smooth muscle has either tropomyosin or troponin, I forget which, and not the other one. But in smooth muscle, it's not the binding of troponin that binds the calcium and triggers the contraction. It is, in fact, calmodulin. Last question, and then we're going to go on. Yeah?
Since the myosin and the actin is not attached anywhere, what makes it not overshoot when it's relaxed?
Something about not overshooting when it's relaxed. There are other proteins in here holding things together, which we have ignored, which essentially limits how far it goes, etc. Okay. So there are a couple of pieces here we have to put in. And one of them is, where does the calcium come from and what triggers the release of calcium into the cytoplasm? Now, you remember we were talking before about stimulation. For smooth muscle, you can get from the parasympathetic, the sympathetic, or hormones. But for the skeletal, you can only get it from a motor neuron. So we had this little picture up here. And we want to go back and look at it more closely. We know now that the action potential comes down the motor neuron. It causes the release of calcium, actually, in the opening of voltage-gated calcium channels, which causes exocytosis, which causes release of neurotransmitter. And then the neurotransmitter binds to the receptors on the special structure on the postsynaptic side. And this special structure here is called the end plate. And at this special structure, you get a graded response. You get a local depolarization depending on the amount, and the amount depends on the amount of action potentials. Now, if you have a nerve synapsing on a nerve, so action potential comes down the nerve, you release neurotransmitter, and you cause an excitatory postsynaptic potential on this side, on the postsynaptic side. Is that enough to trigger an action potential? Is one action potential coming in enough to signal one action potential going out? And the answer is no. It takes multiple action potentials coming into a nerve to get it to do anything. But it's different with a muscle. One action potential causes enough depolarization to trigger an action potential in the muscle membrane. So instead of calling it excitatory postsynaptic potential, it's called an end plate potential. End plate potential. And it's always excited. And one action potential gives you one end plate potential, can give you one action potential in the muscle member. Now, if you have an action potential in the muscle membrane, that triggers the ER to release calcium. But the question is, how do you get the word from the membrane on the outside of the muscle to the ER? The ER, after all, is deep inside the cell. So if you look at the pictures on the web or in your books, you'll see that here's your muscle. Here's the nerve coming in. And it may have several endings with Bouton. But this nerve, this presynaptic side, is all on the outside. And it releases neurotransmitter. And the receptors in this special area here pick up that neurotransmitter. And now, by the way, those receptors, are they direct or indirect? That is, are they ionotropic or metabotropic? This is actually direct ionotropic. This is the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor type synapse. So the neurotransmitter directly causes the opening of channels and the movement in of sodium and depolarization. But even so, you generate an action potential in this muscle membrane. But you have to now release calcium from the ER, and the ER is way inside the cell. So how are you going to do that? The easiest way to explain that is like this. Okay. So if this is the surface membrane, you have indentations in the membrane, which are like this. If I can push it hard enough. They go like if you put the finger hole inside. Instead of the finger sticking out, the finger goes in. So you have extensions of the membrane, indentations in the membrane. Here's the membrane, and you have one of those indentations like a finger pointing in. And so the action potential goes all the way down this membrane. These are called T-tubules. And the action potential goes all the way down these things. And the ER is in here. Or, since this is muscle, the SR, the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So the action potential here change triggers the opening of channels in the ER. These two are coupled. The exact details we won't go into. But the action potential, it's probably mechanical. The action potential passing now through this inside the cell in these internal membrane protrusions is sufficient to open channels in the ER, and that releases the calcium. And that's what causes the muscle to contract. Now, we want to look at the third handout because we want to see what happens in terms of the muscle contracting. the point of this handout is to try and explain the properties of different contractile and electrically conducting cells in terms of their channels and the flow of ions. That each cell type here, skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, pacemaker cells, etc., each one has a slightly different collection of channel proteins in its membrane, and that leads to different ion flows, and that leads to different properties. So if you look at the very first upper left picture, this shows you what is happening in the muscle. In a skeletal muscle, you generate an action potential in the skeletal muscle membrane, which is very short. And that triggers, this is one action potential in the nerve, triggers one action potential in the muscle, triggers one contraction, which is called a twitch. And the second picture here, the second part of this picture, shows you the contraction here, or it says tension over here. This is the scale for that. This is the scale for this. That the tension developed by the muscle is like this. Now that means that the cell contracts up to this point, holds it for a little bit, and then loses the contraction and relaxes. And this is one twitch, one kick, one twitch. But the point of, notice the relative size of the two of them. The action potential is much shorter than the contraction. So, can I do another action potential before the contraction is over? I could do another one here. I could kick in another one. Or I could kick in another action potential, etc. I can have action potentials coming down the nerve, causing new action potentials in the muscle, causing additional contraction. And that's how you get the next picture over on the right. Each little arrow here represents another action potential. And so the scale is different of contraction. So the muscle contracts a little, but then before it can relax very much, it gets another kick, gets another action potential. So it contracts some more. And then before it can relax, it gets another one, and so on. Until eventually, the muscle contracts as much as it can. Now, if you continue to stimulate it, it will break actin, myosin bridges, remake, break, remake, break, remake. But it stays contracted. But it doesn't contract and get any shorter because it can't. It's got the maximum overlap. And this is called tetanus. Now, tetanus is a horrible disease, but you can see that there are times when, in fact, you want tetanus. You want to contract your muscle and hold it to generate force. But your heart is a different business. Your heart is very similar. Heart muscle, contractile heart muscle, and skeletal muscle have a very similar bridge cycle. But the timing is different. And that's shown underneath. Because let me ask a question. Do you want your heart in tetanus? You do not. You want your heart to contract, and then no matter who kicks it, you want it to relax at the right time, and then wait for another kick, and then contract and relax. So if you look at the relative difference here, the action potential in a muscle, in a skeleton, in a heart contractile muscle is like this. So this is the action potential. Notice the difference. The action potential is much, much longer. So that means that the cell, you can't fire another action potential because you have a very, very long refractory period. Remember that you can't fire a second action potential until the cell repolarizes, and now you can do it again. But there's a period when the cell is very depolarized, when the sodium channels are locked and you can't open them. So now what happens if you stimulate the muscle? The muscle contracts and relaxes with about the same timing. Can I fire another action potential in the heart here? I cannot. I can't fire another action potential in the heart until I get out here. And that's what keeps your heart from getting stuck in the contracted position, because you can't give it another action potential until it has relaxed. And the difference here is because of the difference in channels. What happens in a regular action potential? You open sodium channel, voltage-gated sodium channels. Here you open potassium and you recover. But now, this, the last piece we're going to look at today is to look at the very right picture, which shows you what happens in the heart muscle. Why do you get a picture that looks like this for the action potential? And the answer is that you have different channels and therefore different ions flowing, that you start the same way with sodium going in because you open sodium channels. But now when you close the sodium up here, you don't open potassium channels. Instead of opening potassium channels, you actually open calcium channels. The calcium flows into the cell and keeps the cell depolarized for a long time. And then you close the calcium channels and you open the potassium channels. And when you finally open the potassium channels, the cell repolarizes, goes back to its normal resting membrane potential, and now we can fire another action potential and get it to contract again. Now, the point we're making here is that these differences are due to which proteins are being made, which, as you now know, depends on which transcription factors are present in the cell, which ultimately controls everything. Now, what we're going to do next time is we'll talk a little bit more about the heart and circulation, some of the pieces we got didn't get to, and wrap that up. And then we're going to talk about homeostasis. Now, exam number 3 will cover everything we did today and no more. So it won't cover anything that we do next time, any piece of the heart we haven't gotten to, but it will cover smooth and skeletal muscle. And I want to remind you that there is no class on Thursday. If it's not a holiday by you, just take the day off and enjoy. And next Tuesday, the evening class starts early.